So the next poem, you all right? You're doing all right? This poem is another late poem by Richard Wilbur, who was a friend of Robert Frost, as it happens. There's a lovely thing that Wilbur says about Frost at the end of his life, trying to say to Wilbur, I've really appreciated talking to you because you're someone I can talk to who understands me. And for Frost, that was quite rare to have that. You know, Wilbur was a young man at the time. Wilbur is only 4 years older than Bante, so he's very much a sort of contemporary of Bante's. He became famous as a Second World War poet. His first collection, which was called, can't remember now, anyway, there's a famous poem in it called First Snow at Alsace. He saw active service in Italy, and obviously very violent active service. He'd lived through some of the horrors of the Second World War, and he said he started writing poems to keep himself sane. You know, he'd go away and try and write something. Weirdly, not so well known in England. He's up there with someone like Frost. His collected poems is huge, but again, and partly people don't like him. I think he has a happy marriage. Him and his wife got a lovely poem in the last collection about the death of his wife, exquisite, you know, really happy marriage. He talks about her all the time, very, very positively, happy children, no problems. He was, you know, his first collection, everyone raved about it, you know, again, he won the Pulitzer Prize, taught at Harvard, you know, did the whole thing, highly respectable, very, rather buttoned and rather respectable. People don't seem to like that about him. He wasn't an alcoholic, you know, comes from a sort of middle class. Well, actually, weirdly, he had a very odd story. His father was quite poor. Father was a sort of poor man and a gardener. So this is a son of a gardener. And his father happened to meet this American aristocrat who really liked him and said, why don't you come to my stately home and be my gardener? Move the whole family. I think Richard Wilbur's got a sister, I can't quite remember. Moved the whole family to this aristocratic house. So his dad's a gardener, and suddenly they're living in this, for the most of Wilbur's life, living in this incredible American aristocrat's mansion, you know, and he had the run of the place. And so he had this incredible kind of patrician upbringing, but just because his dad was a gardener, and you know, this aristocrat, I can't remember who it was now, just liked him, you know, and trusted him. So people are very critical of Wilbur. I think some of the reasons that he writes very good comic poetry, and people are a bit snooty about that. There's one about I think it's called The Prisoner of Zenda that starts, in the ender, the prisoner of Zenda, the king being out of danger, Stuart Granger, very, you know, all these very funny writings. Very, very funny rhymes. He could write very funny poems. He also wrote at least, I think, 3 books of children's poems that are very funny, and he did his own little drawings in them. He also wrote hymns. You know, how unfashionable is that? He was an Episcopalian, I think, and quite devout, I think, but very unwilling to talk about that, but very religious Christian. Wrote hymns, very famous for translations, particularly of things like Racine, mostly French translation, very famous translation of The Misanthrope, for instance. His poems are criticised for being too beautiful and too formal. I would say, if you looked at his collected poems, 3/4 of it is in rhyme and metre, with very standard rhyme forms and so on. So people think of him as old-fashioned and backward-looking and all that sort of thing. He's always written beautiful, very traditional, as it were, rhyming work. But, you know, absolute master, I think. His best poems are wonderful. And what a great problem to be too beautiful. We don't value that anymore. We much prefer people to be down there with the kids and swear a bit. That would be something that Wilbur would never do in a poem. There's one poem where he has the word concrete in it, and he was terribly pleased. And in the reading, he says, I'm very pleased with this because it's got the word concrete in it. You know, very pleased it managed to write this very coarse word, yeah, into his poem, you know. Anyway, he wrote this in his last collection, which is so slight a connection that the poems are only printed on one side of the paper because there's so few of them. He wrote it when he was 93. He died last October, having just published his last collection, and had been writing all his life. You know, as I said, his first major collection was about, you know, all his Second World War poems. So very light Bantu, following that whole tradition, that whole time. So let's hear this one.
A measuring worm. This yellow-striped green caterpillar climbing up the steep window screen, constantly, for lack of a full set of legs, keeps humping up his back. It's as if he's sent by a sort of semaphore, dark omegas meant to warn of last things. Although he doesn't know it, he will soon have wings. And I too don't know toward what undreamt condition, inch by inch, I go.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful. Absolute knockout. I saw a reading of him, and he said this is one of my poems in the Chinese style, which I'm very pleased with. Now, this is unbelievably good, this poem. It's tiny, it's only that big. Tiny thing. There we go, that's all it is. Three line stanzas. I'll take you through. It's interesting, a measuring worm is a particular kind of worm as well. It's actually a name as well as, but you know, because I was thinking he's obviously got Hamlet in mind, you know, that's the famous scene, you know, where is he at lunch? Not where he's eating, but where he is being eaten. A certain sort of politic worms is even now at him, you know, so I was assuming it was a reference to Hamlet, a measuring worm, you know, measuring out your life and so on, eating you when you're dead. But it's actually also just simply a name of a kind of grub, a larvae. So this yellow-striped green caterpillar climbing up the steep window screen constantly, in brackets, for lack of a full set of legs, keeps humping up his back. Now that's a perfect description because, you know, they've got legs at the front and legs at the back, and to move they do that, and their back goes up like that, constantly. And then what's clever about it, for lack of a full set of legs, is in brackets. So the sentence itself is doing what the measuring worm is doing. Constantly, for lack of a full set of legs, is humping up his back. So actually, literally, the brackets do also show you the shape of the measuring worm. It's as if he's sent by a sort of semaphore, dark amigas meant to warn of last things. And the amiga, of course, also is that shape. It's that dash, isn't it, with an O and the dash again. Dark amigas meant to warn of last things. Last things is capitalized. Which is incredible, isn't it? Although he doesn't know it, he will soon have wings. And then that wonderful, and then stanza break, and I too don't know towards what undreamt condition, inch by inch, I go. Yeah, I mean, so wonderful that it feels so casual that how I imagine it is, you know, his wife or his daughter has gone to the shops with him, parked up the car. She's gone into, I don't know why, this is how I imagine it. She's gone into the shop and he's seen a, you know, this scrub go up the window screen. But you see how clever it is, climbing up the steep window screen, constantly, for lack of a full set of legs, keeps humping up his back. Now, is that him or is that the grub? Constantly, for a lack of a full set of legs. And that's how you feel at that. He's 93 when he's writing this. Keeps humping up his back. You know, presumably he's like that as well. It's as if he's sent by a sort of semaphore, dark amigas meant to warn of last things. Yeah. So it all feels like it is just talking about him, although subtly he's in the background. Although he doesn't know it, he will soon have wings. And I too don't know toward what undreamt condition, inch by inch, I go. So that's a wonderful, both the description of the movement of the measuring worm, but also how he walked inch by inch. You know, he's a very elderly man with a humped back, saying, "And I too don't know toward what undreamt condition, inch by inch, I go." But isn't that what I really like about this? It follows very well from the frost, because his instinct is, because he's a very ardent Christian, his instinct is that I think it will be positive. And I think that's really important. Although he doesn't know it, he will soon have wings. And I too don't know. So still honest. He's not saying, "And I'm going to be like an angel because I believe in God." He's not a stupid person. "And I too don't know towards what undreamt condition, inch by inch, I go." Yeah. Incredible affirmation, but again, very honest. Not affirming any more than he can affirm. Yeah. Unbelievably clever, this poem, I think. Although he doesn't know it, he will soon have wings. And, you know, for him, that must have a reference to angels and so on. And I too don't know, which is, from that background, really a strikingly honest thing to say. And I too don't know. And we all need to learn that I too don't know toward what undreamt condition, inch by inch, I go. So you've got that lovely, simple rhyming scheme, green, screen, lack, back, they're all full rhymes. What is even unbelievably clever is each stanza is a haiku, a perfect haiku. So each stanza has got 17 syllables in a 5-7-5 syllable count. Hold it up. So each of those verses is a haiku in its own right, with a strict haiku. So it's all he's done is rhyme the end line and the last line, but it's still 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables for each of those. How he's done that, I really don't know. So you've got the rhyme scheme, which is creating a form that he has to fit, but he also has to fit this incredibly complex haiku form and pull that off without you noticing it. And it has to sound like it's just how he talks naturally. And he actually has to say something with all that, you know. And of course, it's a Chinese form, so that's referring him to all of those death poems, those, you know, haikus, to that whole... The haiku is very much about profundity in small things, isn't it? You know, even in Kyoto, the cuckoo's cry, "I long for Kyoto," is one haiku. It's always trying to say, in the tiniest thing, some massive profundity, particularly about impermanence. So he's referencing all of that tradition, and writing a poem in rhyming verses that are all haikus. I mean, I was so staggered when I discovered that. Then I actually counted the syllables. I thought, you can't have done that. That's too clever. But they all are 5-7-5. Remarkable.